Good afternoon. I'm really thrilled to be part of this panel, and I really appreciate the exciting results of the research that's come up so far, and so I'm honored to be a part of this. My name is Doris Bartel. I work for CARE. I'm a senior program advisor for our sexual and reproductive health team. CARE's work, as Sarah might have alluded to earlier, CARE is an organization that works in about 70 countries globally, working on poverty issues, which includes work on health programming. My presentation is focused more on the programmatic application of the work that you've been hearing so far in this panel in terms of the research results. So the question is, what happens now? How do you apply these research findings in the field? So I'll be presenting on a resource we developed called the Inner Spaces, Outer Faces Initiative Toolkit. This was jointly developed by CARE and ICRW, the International Center for Research on Women. And I'd really like to acknowledge the brilliant contributions of Sarah Cambu in the development of this toolkit. We worked together for many years. So the Inner Spaces, Outer Faces initiative, we have worked with for a number of years, so we've shortened it down to ISOFI, which you may hear me, it may revert to calling it ISOFI instead of the full name. And this is really a systematic set of tools for how to integrate sexuality, including a focus on sexual pleasure, into our international HIV and sexual and reproductive health programming. Why did we call it Inner Spaces and Outer Faces? Oh, yeah, no disclosures. Why did we call it Inner Spaces and Outer Faces? We initiated this program with the encouragement and funding from the Ford Foundation because we realized that we often ask our staff to implement programs that stretch their personal boundaries and comfort zones with regard to sexuality. We hire people to work with socially marginalized groups, with HIV-positive people and with sex workers, and ask them to speak about sexually explicit topics, but we rarely give them the opportunity to talk about their own experiences or biases, but their own beliefs or values about sexuality. And this is often such a taboo topic that they have a really hard time talking about it. And as others have said, you know, in our public health framework, we have a really risk-based idea about HIV prevention and sexual and reproductive health, and it isn't necessarily a full model. So just for example, our staff in India and Vietnam, where we did this work, who are all local people working in their own communities, they've often never spoken with a sex worker in their lives, but they're being asked to do that every day, and their families are saying, "Why are you doing that?" So we wanted to give them an opportunity to think through those things and to think through some of those stigma issues. And as Sarah said, our programs in HIV prevention began to explore sexuality as a social construct in South Asia with a focus on sexual pleasure, and it led to our pilot learning initiative in India and Vietnam. So the Inner Spaces, Outer Faces initiative focused on building our staff capacity to examine our own beliefs and values about sex and sexuality and about gender, and then encouraging our staff to adapt the program interventions in their own way to become more sex positive. And that includes questioning the gender power dynamics that have been considered by many to be immutable or unchangeable. And I really appreciate Sarah's slides earlier on the philosophy of ICRW and thinking through the social construct of sexuality embedded in a rights framework, which means that we're aiming for people to achieve their sexual rights, which includes mutually consensual sex as well as pleasure, and also the right to refuse sex. And because gender power dynamics are so tied into the sexuality work, I want to acknowledge that gender equity is one of our fundamental aims as well. So the four steps that I'll be talking about in this presentation is the basic how-to. How do you do this? We started by creating a safe space for self-reflection for our staff. The second step was to explore the issues of sexuality in the program participants where we're working, because we're not necessarily assuming that our own staff, our own experiences as staff, are really the experiences of our program participants. We want to hear their stories and let them tell us what sexual pleasure means to them. And the third step was an adaptation process of adapting the program interventions to become more sex positive. as well as encouraging participants to address the issues they felt were most pertinent to their lives. And the fourth step was coming together every 4 months or so to really rethink how the process was going and seeing where things were going well or where things were going wrong. And those four steps were repeated through the course of the program. So I'll be talking about each of these in a little bit more detail. So when you do a workshop on sexuality for your staff, it becomes a little bit uncomfortable. So we wanted to create a safe space, and we kept our training workshops fairly small, with no more than about 15 people, and it was women and men together, all local people from the local community. And this was a safe space for them to share their experiences and ideas and beliefs about sexuality and gender. The facilitators for these workshops were hired locally, so they represented culturally appropriate but progressive and thoughtful people who could sensitively handle the subject matter. And they set clear ground rules that facilitated a sense of cooperation and safety for the group, including confidentiality. And people were really unused to talking about sex, so we split people up into smaller groups of twos or threes, men with men and women with women, and had them start sharing that way and let them take their own pace about how they wanted to share with each other about their experiences. And sometimes, I have to say, using analogies like food helps people open up a little bit. So a typical workshop exercise would be body mapping. And you'll see some pictures here from Vietnam where people lie down on the floor. You saw a picture of this in Sarah's presentation also. And you either use a chalk outline or use a pen and draw around a body and then have small groups identify areas on the body of pleasure, pain, power, and shame, and then share them back with the rest of the group. We also did ideal man and ideal woman visuals, either with sculpture or with drawing. And that helps people to think through how society expects, what society expects of us in terms of our behavior, our characteristics as men or women, and what the reality is as compared to the ideal. So once our own staff had worked through some of their own beliefs and values, we recognized that we didn't necessarily know how our program participants viewed the constructs and meanings of sexuality and gender. You know, most of us are middle-class, well-educated people, and so we may not have the same biases or experiences. So we developed these exercises to use at the community level to explore the understandings of sexuality at another level. And our staff were often surprised by how easily people shared their understandings and their expectations for sex. So you'll see a couple of quotes here from our program participants emerging from the exploratory work from body mapping. The third step is adapting our interventions to take into consideration some of these issues. So once we understood some of the issues, our staff could adjust the programs. One example that you see here emerged from working with the truckers in India. Now, the staff had assumed that the truckers were having sex with sex workers along their trucking routes, and so they had designed their interventions to have risk reduction measures based on that. But in their exploratory work about sexuality with the truckers, what they found, the truckers talked a lot about cab sex. Cab sex is sex with men between men and men, and it's sometimes consensual and sometimes not. The power dynamics are problematic in that the driver can ask the helper for sex, and the helper has to do it because he's an apprentice and it's his career, and he has to comply or risk losing his not just the job but the whole career. So the intervention really addressed the power dynamics around the non-consensual sex in this case. And so the picture you see on the left is a puppet show describing how the helper had more information about HIV and HIV prevention and kind of turned the power dynamic on its head a little bit and got the truckers engaged in the power dynamic issue and what was consensual and what was non-consensual. Our team reflection meetings we put into place because we realized that one-off workshops are really not enough. So we wanted to bring the teams back together routinely to discuss how things were going, whether well or not so well, so they could make adjustments along the way and support each other in their journeys of change. In terms of the lessons from our SOFI work, I would say I really appreciate the value of those consistent learning action cycles where people had the opportunity to go out into the community, find things out that were new to them, apply it in their programs, and then move forward with their own modifications for their interventions. They found that really empowering, and they came up with some very interesting and innovative adjustments or tweaks to their programs that I have never seen before. So that was great. And the expert facilitator was really useful because a person like that can help push the envelope for thinking a little bit, push the teams to just think outside the box a little bit. In terms of the work on sexuality and gender, I mean, especially sexual pleasure programming, you have to consider that the organization has to be really supportive of this kind of work, and you have to get buy-in from the highest levels, because when you ask people to think outside the box and say sexuality and gender are really social constructs, and we have to decide, like, what are we going to do with this information now? They start questioning the social constructs of other power dynamics also. So people in our India program started questioning the caste system. And they started looking at CARE's bureaucratic hierarchy and said, why is it the way this is? So we really have to be prepared for that level of intelligent questioning on the part of our staff when we open up the opportunities to really think critically about this kind of work. I also see that people took really serious personal and professional risks, and you have to consider how to put into place support systems for people who are really stepping outside the box and stepping outside the boundaries of what's socially acceptable in those communities, some of them very conservative, and figure out how to build some kind of safety net for people who are moving faster than their community members or their families might like. So what are we doing now with this kind of programming? We're doing some very exciting and interesting operations research in India to test whether this kind of programming will make an impact on health outcomes. So that includes maternal morbidity and mortality and, not mortality, maternal morbidity and infant mortality and morbidity. And we're also expanding into countries in Africa. So the how-to toolkit that Sarah's holding up right now in hard copy is available. You can write to me at this address, and I can send you a hard copy or a CD-ROM. I have a big pile of CD-ROMs here on the table, so you're welcome to come up and take one if you'd like today. You can also download it all at either CARE's website or ICRW's website, which are listed here. So I'd like to thank and acknowledge all the program participants in our program who shared with us all of their insights and showed us the way, as well as my co-author on this paper, Aparajita Mukherjee from ICRW, and thanking the CARE staff in India and Vietnam, as well as Veronica Magar, who helped conceptually with this presentation. Thanks.
Please give me one more, join me in giving one more round of applause for our panelists.
That's great. Thank you so much.
And we have plenty of time for questions. Also, it would be wonderful to hear if people are also trying to incorporate pleasure and sex positivity into their programming and policies. We'd love to hear from you as well. I think I saw a hand in the back. Are you referring to the relationship between satisfaction and vibrator use?
No. I'm talking about the positive life choices, like healthy choices, correlating to the satisfaction of sexual satisfied.
The correlations between health behaviors, such as that the correlation there is with vibrator use as well. So there's a relationship between sexual satisfaction and having used a vibrator, and there's also a relationship between having used a vibrator and making choices such as to have a gynecological exam or to perform a testicular exam or breast self exam or not breast, testicular or genital, and that's from our data, from the study.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. for women.
Yeah.
And what that is.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that as a recommendation. And also, yeah. The whole efficacy of breast self exam.
Right.
Really question is generally
right.
not recommended.
Absolutely.
So I'm wondering about that in your research.
Yeah, in terms of a genital self-examination, you're right. It's one of these health behaviors that certain groups recommend and others don't say anything about. For example, the American Cancer Society, if you go to their website and look up issues related to vulvar cancer, you'll find some information about it, but they really sort of tiptoe around the subject instead of making it an absolute recommendation. Now, generally, gynecologists flat out recommend it. The International Society for the Study of Vulvovaginal Disease recommends it. So groups that are really focused on genital health tend to, unfortunately, some of the more major ones will provide information about it without coming out precisely about it. So in our study, knowing that people would not necessarily know what this was, we've done other work involving issues around this too, is we describe it, and we also describe or looking closely at your genitals for changes and so on. And so, because we know that they're not used to this terminology. Now, in terms of breast self-examination, you're absolutely right. In terms of the research, there's a lot of question about the value of performing this in terms of early detection. And yet, as far as what women hear, you know, they are certainly hearing a message in terms of mainstream media that it does have value, and many women still do that, and many doctors still ask women if they do that. In terms of our interest in using it, we were more interested in using it as a marker of their comfort and their relationship with different parts of their body. And so to have something like the genital self-examination versus the breast, we thought we might be able to help tease out some of these comfort issues, which is what happened. Yeah. We certainly have data related to sexual orientation and identity. Certainly, as you would expect in a nationally representative sample, we have a smaller percentage of people who identify as gay, lesbian, or bisexual. For women, actually, I think it was about 1.4% identified as lesbian, and several more identified as bisexual. So we haven't done separate analyses yet, but we certainly plan to. To comfort or to use? We certainly found vibrator use across the categories. Now, we have some other data that's not presented here today, but about perceptions of women's vibrator use. And in some cases, there were some beliefs that people have about vibrator use that are more prevalent around extremely conservative or conservative types. But in terms of use, we found that across the categories and across different religious identifications, too, as well as geographic region and so on.
Yeah, in the back of the purple shirt. Yeah.
I've been conducting over the years a series of studies, and there's been concerning HIV risk reduction in American women predominantly in the Black community. And it's pretty much known in the literature that higher trust relates to higher unprotected sex. But my findings, over 1,000 women now are lower trust. And that meant that women were having sex with men they knew or suspected were having sex with other women, less frequently sex with men, but they understood that their men were engaging in risky behaviors and still had unprotected sex with men. This led us to go to qualitative focus groups. In Newark and Jersey City, we held focus groups concerning why are women having unprotected sex with men they know and they're sitting around. And the answers came slowly. And the answers are predominantly that I'm a man because it feels better, number one. Number two, if I ask him to use a condom, he's going to think I have sex with someone or that I think he had sex with someone. And so deeper into the research, having quantitative, series of quantitative studies after that, we saw that there's a difference between trusting your partner and feeling the need to show trust to your partner. So, and that's a form of sexual pressure. We've been doing, we have a sexual pressure scale now in urban women. The point I want to make is that we really, I think your work is very important. Sex and sexuality and sensuality is part of life, especially for younger women. But anyway.
Hey, now. Hey.
And so we're creating to, that we look at that associative memory processing. And so what we want to do is substitute another script, and that's a common detective script that emphasizes pleasure and also how good it feels, you know, trust requirement to use a condom. And so we're working in those areas.
Could you tell us where we might find your videos that you mentioned?
Yes, thanks for asking. We have a website. You can watch our pilot videos sponsored by the NIH, and we can vary with a good pilot study large effect size. www.stophiv.newark.rutgers.edu. And this was a study we conducted on video capable small handheld computers. And we're now turning that 1 43-minute soap opera video, a story by Tony Michael Mallory, into a 12 sequel video we were funded to expand. And we just today found out that we're being funded by NIH to test this series on cell phones. So the soap opera is a format in the genre of entertainment education that has been tested in India, in some states in India and in South Africa, and began in Mexico, Miguel Cervito's work. So I wanted to point that out there because we use the term soap opera, we think about what we see in the middle of the day, what some of us see in the middle of the day, but it's a very genetic term to describe the melodrama that is love and sex.
Thank you so much for sharing. That's great. Yeah, I believe you had a question. I can try my best to speak on behalf of Roger, but I was really just presenting for him, but go ahead. And
so was it a man doing half the interviews and a woman doing the other half of the interviews, or was it a separate person who was trained to be just so that?
My understanding is that the 20 interviews I presented on here today were only with young women, and Harriet, the co-author, conducted all those interviews. Yeah, that's my understanding. Yeah. Yeah. And did you have one other question? Those were the demographics of the entire sample. That was not related to vibrator use.
Okay.
Somebody had asked a question about that, so I was responding to...
So you were mostly presenting data of people who were very educated that did not have children?
Actually...
Is that your
I wouldn't say that most of them didn't have children.
Well, I don't know. It's
not No, certainly many of them have children. More than half of them are married. So they really reflect the demographics of the United States population in terms of the sample. And we have, you know, even more specific data in terms of the age of the children that they have in the home, 0 to 2, 2 to 5, 6 to 12, 13 to 17, and so on. So I couldn't tell you the age breakdown for each of them. That's of the whole sample. But I do know from doing some other analyses recently in the last few weeks that certainly it's even across, doesn't matter sort of what age child you have in the home, there are people who are using sex toys as part of their relationships.
I just think that it looked to me, you know, that you were sampling a greater number.
No, about less than a third of them, I think, even had a college education, maybe about 30, 31% or so. So, no. Mm-mm.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. We're really struggling with what's individual behavior change and what's social change. And that, I think that leads to your question about how much pressure we all put on each other to conform to what's considered to be, you know, our expected roles in our cultures, in our societies, in our communities, in our you know, networks or our spheres. And one of the things that I found has worked fairly well to open up the space for dialogue around those expectations are opening up public dialogues around that, what did you call it, the script. So we often use theater or puppet shows or videos to portray a script of what appears to be not normal. And then open it up to the broad community and say, what do you think about this? It doesn't appear to be normal, and yet people are it actually happens in your community, right? And we take the scripts from people's narratives of what's actually happening to them. So we know it's very common in the community, even though it doesn't conform to the script. And people in the public sphere, when you get people to comment on it, they say, yeah, that really happens. And we say, well, what do you think about it? And they say, one person will raise their hand and say, well, I think that person in the script, you know, that person in the theater sketch should have done this other thing. And another, that we ask for volunteers, and they come up and change places with the actors on the stage, and they portray bodily a different script in front of their peers, their community. And the peers, some of them say, you know, that's a much better script. So it opens up the space for dialogue and for people to say, you know, the script that we're assuming may not be the right one for us. That means that we as programmers are not imposing a script on them. The community is developing their own new script for what's normal, and it widens out the perception of what's normal. So it allows for greater variation in how people are playing out those expectations for how they're supposed to be behaving. And I think it's very positive. It's part of the safety net that I think we all need. I mean, we're pushing the envelope, I think, on a lot of this stuff, and we need each other as support systems.
I wanted to make a comment in regard to that, because I think, you know, you're bringing up a really important point about about providers, public health professionals, healthcare providers being able to normalize some sexuality issues for individuals. You know, vibrators and other sexual enhancement products have been recommended for decades in sex therapy, and yet one of the barriers to their uptake, to their use, is people saying, I don't know that people do that. I don't know that, you know, nice women should be doing that. I was told that that's not okay, and so on. And particularly in response to, you know, the incredible prevalence of sexual problems and dysfunction following treatments for cancer. You know, we recently completed a study in our group, too, on the sexual problems that are experienced by young survivors of breast cancer, and it was across the board in these categories. They are, you know, they also tend to be very interested in products that could help them, but they're not hearing about them from their providers. And often, as you're expressing too, there's just this lack of data, or maybe a sense within an institutional structure that you're not allowed to speak comfortably in these areas too. So I, you know, thank you for bringing that up.
Yes, sir.
I think that, you know, this is an important point that you're raising, and I think it also speaks to the issue of the presence or absence of data. Because there is certainly a general sense that whatever people are putting into their bodies, whether it's a vibrator or hand or partner's body part, that it should not pose a risk to you, and that, you know, to the extent that you can, that you would want to reduce that risk. We actually do not have good data on the risk of infection from using vibrators or from hand masturbation. We have, you know, more data from partner sex, of course. So I think there is a need for that. We certainly have, you know, we, like I said, we do have quite a lot of data. So we do have data on actually very high rates of cleaning behaviors for women and men in terms of taking care of their vibrators. But I absolutely agree that as we talk more about sexuality, whether it's masturbation or the use of sex toys, and hopefully that we talk more about partner sex too, that we talk about ways to minimize any risks. But it seems, you know, it seems so far from the data that we have that there are very few risks and very high protective behaviors going on, but we'll need to keep studying this as we continue to study the full range of sexual behaviors. And certainly masturbation and toy use, although there may be some bacterial transfer possibility, there, you know, they're certainly much lower of a risk than something like unprotected partner sex too. So keeping in the different rates of risk for different things for comparable sake. Yeah.
One final question before we close. All right, or come up and speak to our panelists afterwards. Thanks everyone for your attention.
Thank you. your pen on my bed.
I'm sorry.
No problem. Thanks for coming.
I had no intention of
saying that. No, I know you didn't mean to say
that.
Oh, excellent. Sweet. By all means, I'm sorry. I thought you had a question about the last. So you can just close this out.